I'm not going to overdo it because all of the background is laid out completely. There are some things I'm not going to tell because I don't want them to know. I'm not talking about strategy here. And one say, well, what about the fact that there is no copy of a cashier's check? Well, we'll face that because all of you need to know a little bit about the sequence of events that led to any encounter with anybody. The Eckers have a fine background. Now, I'm going to start by saying that if you are going to look for a pattern of misbehavior, where do you look? If you're trying to find someone who has a habit of conning people or doing ill deeds, don't you go back to see what they have been all of their lives, especially in their business lives, in their more recent encounters? What would they find if they went into Ecker's background? They would find at least 12 years as an executive of Transamerica, and on back there, a very highly respected officer or at least vice president level of qualification with Surety Life in Salt Lake. EJ was brought to California to build for Occidental Life a merged program of mutual funds and life insurance, chosen out of all of the ones around the country. He was the authority on that. That's what he had been doing. So he comes to Occidental Transamerica with that kind of a reputation and fills his job with Transamerica Financial for 12 years. Dorma had been a secretary. We can go back farther. She ran a clinic in Detroit for Jewish doctors. Then everybody takes time out to have a family. She was married to a physician, a respected physician. And so we don't need to go through all of the things, but one of her stints of duty was as a secretary for the Attorney General of the state of Utah, where she knew the members of the Supreme Court of Utah personally. They would have been willing to perform a wedding for her, you know, that sort of a relationship. First name friendship. EJ and Doris go out in the evening, and General Rich comes, you know, and it's buddy-buddy down the street. These are not slobs. I don't choose slobs. I choose ones that can get the job done and have volunteered to serve. She goes to work with Jewish doctors at Children's Hospital of Los Angeles in the highest clerical position in the division and puts in more than 10 years in that position, building an entire transplant program that finally moved into bone marrow, heart, liver, lung, anything that is done at Children's Hospital of Los Angeles, she was involved in birthing. That hardly is a con man's position. They left those to go and start an alternative energy business. I won't go into that, but in the next few years, they came to do wind. When they came to Tehachapi, it was out of a bankruptcy, yes, but they had a $60,000 home that was now worth $400,000 or more. And the taxes were going to eat them alive. They chose bankruptcy, at which point the sellers paid them enough to get the house. They wanted the house. It was on an acre of land prime land in one of the most expensive areas on that side of Los Angeles, Chevy Chase, La Crescenta. And to own an acre of prime land with 21 beautiful, magnificent olive trees. Nineteen years they were there and raised family. But it was now time to make some decisions. What do you want to do? What are you going to do? And everybody in here can go check it out if they want. Will Treese of Westinghouse Wind Energy contacted Mr. Ecker and asked him to head up a wind park in Tehachapi. I'm talking about the same Westinghouse that Mr. Tesla worked for. And then they merged and they wanted to do this wind development with Mitsubishi and SeaWest. Mr. Ecker controlled the land out there at that moment with a partner. And if you go out and down Oak Creek, you're going to see hundreds of Mitsubishi machines running. That was to have been Ecker's park. So don't you just think maybe with letters of agreement in place that maybe when Ecker's came out to Tehachapi, they were not destitute street people? By that time, Dorma had begun to write a little bit. Just a novel. She'd lost a son. She wanted to basically retire. Maybe do a little writing. Wanted to spend time in the social organization of this town. They'd loved it here. Had loved it here. They came to Tehachapi and they wanted to look around to see what might be available. They have a large family. And they were a close family. So they needed a fairly good sized place. Well, the house they got was a perfect marriage. Because the people in the house who offered it for sale had tried to sell it for 3 years. The price was right. They wanted to go to El Paso, Texas. The man was high-level clearance. He had been working in Saudi Arabia, for goodness sakes. And they had stashed up some money, wanted to open an aeronautics business in El Paso. And Marianne just wanted to go away from here. This seemed impossible at the moment. Doris says to her, "How can you want to go, Marianne?" "Oh, I just want away from here." "You'll see." What an interesting woman. Well, Silver Ray got into it, and so did the Golden Ray. Another friend. And said, "This is the perfect place, and this is where you're going to meet your responsibility. And it will happen in the next 4 to 7 years. They will be terrible." "Not for me. I'm going to work with Mitsubishi and have windmills. Don Quixote." So they move. And happiness is all over them. They think. And so in that fall, in that late summer, because she had written Sipapu Odyssey, Sister Thedra, of all the ones that George Green is going to use against Dorma, Sister Thedra decided this was the story of her life. This was it. And many ones came from all around the country to be here that August, that Dorma had no idea what had hit her. And I remember Dorma praying, Father, please, just let us make it through these few days. Just please, I can handle anything if you just let us make it through these few days. I don't know what a convergence is or a conversion. I never heard of this. What in the world is happening here? Little Crow says, just settle down. He came out and did a smoke service to cleanse that house. And then he left. He said, you'll be all right. But it's not going to be easy. Well, it's going to be easy for me because I'm not going to do anything, she said. Cook for 2 weeks and we'll have our 35 or 40 people and we'll have a good time. And we did. Let me tell you, we did. And I said, we. I brought Tuita and David out from Indiana. I said, I have to have a speaker. And that's it. Please get yourselves out there so I can make this introduction. And we did. And she still didn't know. Ashtar comes and bangs her on the head and says, in the next little while, lady, you are going. And she's looking around behind, you know, to see who might be sitting behind her. Only it was 11 at night, and there weren't very many to sit, were there? And he said, in the next short period of time, in your counting, there will be many energies coming, and you will have to get acquainted with all of them. Because this is it. And you will be given the credentials, and you will be given what you need. And we're going to move. We are going to move right through this. This is the place. There is a 2.5 mile crystal underneath the edge of this dwelling and all on this land behind you. And that's the way it started. That had nothing to do with George and Desiree Green. A year went by. Now, all of these things happened, and the trouble and the sale of the house happened in May. May 24th, 1988. 8-8. George Green did not show up out here until 89. How could anything that happened on May 24th, 1988 have anything to do with George Green? But there were a couple of people here at the time of that sale that didn't take place. And I'm not going to give their names. But at that first encounter in that courtroom, Eckers and Gritzner, you can put this one in your pipe too if you need to back it up. There is a man, an accountant in this town named Gritzner. And Mr. Gritzner and the Eckers were on their way to Panama to sign a $33 million contract. And Mr. Horn would not give them an extension of a court date. And he set the court date between Christmas and New Year's, both of which were on weekends. Because they had had to return the sums of money to Mr. William Cudd, put it in your book, the man is now, has been in Belize. I'm not going to tell you where he is. The RTC found his attorney, so you know Stephen Horn knows where his attorney is. We're not going to expose William Cudd, who is now on 3 times a week hemodialysis for kidney failure, to put him through what Mr. Horn puts everybody through. Because they didn't have a copy of a cashier's check. They didn't have a copy of the cashier's check because either Stephen Horn or Jason Brent removed the original signed paper, the copy, and the notes, copies of the notes, from the court file. He His third document, his third copy of that, when that one was missing, and later, after he got back from his trip to Belize at that time, it's all bogged down. And he said, it cannot be bogged down. I sent it certified to the court, and the court knew it. And when he got back, he had the card. Now, look what we have in this wonderful little town. He bundles up a copy, his last, of that cashier's check and the certified receipt card, and he sent it. It just happened that the one who contracts to deliver the mail in Golden Hills was putting the mail in the closet and burning it. And the entire area was up in arms. And apologies were written to the people. In that first encounter, it seemed that Jason Brent was possibly on their side. He insisted to Mr. Horn that he be able to explain what went wrong. What went wrong? John and Eleanor were there. Rick was there. Al was there to witness this. They go to lunch thinking this is fine. Let me tell you just a little bit about what happened in there. Because later, Mr. Mitchell said he had three secretaries from Republic National Bank witness and one realtor named Tom Payne as witness to his sale. Oh. When he was in deposition, he said he did it alone. His words. But these names and these witnesses are splashed all over the margins and in writing and on stickies and everything amongst all of these things, all of these entities. Tom Payne, for goodness sakes, was the mayor of Bakersfield at one time. A realtor, yes. Never heard of this turkey and was furious to have been cited as being there. You had the city treasurer and the city clerk of Bakersfield, both witnesses that nothing happened, and had come to Mojave to testify. And Mr. Horn served a paper at lunch on the judge and came out and told his group that there wouldn't be a hearing. He had fixed it. And just before he came out to do that, Mr. Mitchell came out of the courtroom, having gone in there with Stephen Horn, came out and said, Mr. Horn has fixed it. He heads down and stops in front of Doris and Eleanor sitting to her right. Two ladies who had been with Mr. Mitchell all morning, obviously two of his secretaries going to testify, met him right there. And he says something to them, and both of them lean out and look up the hallway a little bit, and there sits the city clerk and the city treasurer. And one of them blanched out as white as a sheet and said, "My God, what do we do now?" And Mr. Mitchell said, "Don't worry, we go with exactly what was decided." How do you feel for being set up only to find that all of your documents that morning had been removed from your chart, your file? And when it reassembled in the afternoon, because no one could quite believe that it wasn't even going to take place, and the judge comes out, and he has the wrong form. The people had had to do it in pro per. There was no question. There was no sale. Why would they go hire lawyers? Well, then Judge Jason Brent did another dandy. You get a lawyer. I'm ordering you to get a lawyer. That's as unconstitutional as you can get. And then he said, "I'm going to give you 5 days or 8 days or whatever his counting was, meager, because it was going to go over the New Year's weekend to get an attorney and got proper paperwork filed, and he said, and you're going to have to show these two things. A room full of witnesses. This man. They try every lawyer they can conjure out of the phone book. How are you going to get a lawyer on New Year's Eve? To present a case, have it filed and ready to argue on the following Tuesday. They knew it. But they went in prepared. This time, Mr. Horn gets up and stamps his feet and says, ah, but they were supposed to have filed two papers. And you can't accept them this way, Judge. But you said we have to specifically ask for this and this, and there they are. Well, it won't do. It will not do. And when Doris stuck up her hand, you know, like an idiot in a courtroom, I mean, after all, you finally made it past the barrister's bar and you're on the other side. You know, I'm here, can I speak? What did you want? I just want to know how we get justice. You're not here. You are not in this courtroom. I have not acknowledged you. You're not in this courtroom. I'm looking right through you. Justice. This is justice. And I'm going right back to discuss the house. Why, that's a nice house. How could you possibly have that house? And others will say, well, that's none of anybody's business, but I want to tell you something. These people came out here. They had had airplanes. They would take their children out. They had 13 motorcycles they would take out with their children. They have been successful. They found a home that was a third less than they had just moved out of. And I'm going to repeat the question. Whose business is it anyway? And they took care of it. In spite of everything, they took care of it. And it has been enhanced in value. And now they come back, battering, 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 because friends were willing to help hold the house. Dorma actually thought it was 100% Miller's. And maybe it might as well have been, because Tulanians helped, Jean helped, so many helped. And I don't know what all of them were told, but their son was told it may never get back to Doris and EJ. I don't know if they know anything about it, but of course it has been slowly unfolding. And now, yes indeed, there is another problem. Except it is no longer a problem because court has taken care of it. Betty Tootin, Tammy, Steve, and the Rhodes tried to get it into foreclosure. They did everything they could to get it into foreclosure. Court took care of it and apparently allowed the church to buy them out. They don't know. I don't want them to know. Do you really think, in retrospect, when they said, well, wouldn't you, come on, you know you knew. No, she didn't know. And wouldn't you have loved that? No, she wouldn't have loved it. Why wouldn't she love it? These people have called her evil. They have testified against her. They left and stole from the very company that she has a great responsibility for. These people would like to see her dead. They call her evil. Do you really think she would have thrived on that? And I want anybody in this room, in this county, in this state, to tell me that there is anything unethical or immoral. They have them strung up to the cross. You knew. So what if they had known everything? Wouldn't that have been some wise business? And isn't it wise business, as it turns out, these very ones that tried to get it in foreclosure said they only put in because it was a good business deal. They would have the house and the property as collateral. And that was more than anyone could expect out of the Institute that the Eckers had destroyed. I'm doing this because of the case. I'm not doing it to get sympathy for them or anything else. I'm sick to my own soul of this kind of behavior and the rest of you allowing it to continue. Everybody should be allowed, should they? I'm going to ask you to question that pretty carefully. It is not Eckers, do you see? It offends them and it hurts them, but they are not the ones that will lose, do you see? These people are going to make you lose if you lose. They're after Paul's money, Nora's money, Margie's. We'll leave that there because I just wanted to carry you up to 1988 and repeat. These people had a impeccable set of reputations when they came here. They had a letter of agreement with Westinghouse. And as a matter of fact, they asked for a lease option. They didn't want a land contract. Then if anything went south with their business, they'd just move out. That's not what the Haineses wanted. And what that has to do with George Green today is zip. And yet every play, every document, every question is revolving around things that have happened since George went to Nevada. And the lawyers don't seem to... Gene is getting sick. Gene cannot practice law. Mr. Horn put him on notice the first deposition day. He got up and said, I will not sit in the same room with a disbarred attorney practicing law. In other words, Gene has to absolutely do nothing more than paperwork as a paralegal. And it's making him sick. It is making him sick. We have to support him. And it's going to be okay. And why do I let it go on? Because you've got other mountains to cross before you get to the valley. And I cannot ask more of all of you until we get some of these other things cleared out. And then all of you are going to have to get used to the fact I'm going to work where I need to work to get our mission accomplished. I am not concerned about your evil people. The world is made up of evil people. I am going to find the one that will produce for me. And it's going to behoove them to do so. They will be under my protection because I don't like either one of them, either side. One is no better than the other, only different. But one is my supreme enemy. The other is just rotten. I can always deal with rot because God can take care of that. Well, how can you even conceive of such a thing as to allow someone to do this? Easy. Because I'm not trying to save a world. I'm trying to have a pod of a remnant against what they're probably going to do to this planet. And I can most certainly work with them. They need me. They need me. And I'm going to see to it that they continue to need me. And if they don't see fit to need me, I don't think they're going to like these consequences. And they've killed some other people. I don't think they better do much more killing in my fields. But meanwhile, we have to get through these things. And I will take this up with Jean and Paul, whoever's working on these cases, so I can give you a linear sequence of events and tell you what to go look for. Like the clues you're going to find in the Santa Barbara mess in the early 80s. And it was all over the papers. That's all you need to know. You don't need to know exactly who did it. But you're going to know it's all tangled up with the Keatings and all the SNL debacle. And as I said then, and I will repeat, it will work all the way to the presidency. And all we're asking for is some justice, some compensation to pay for the damages that have been created here. And I'm telling you, every time that Mr. Horn pulls another one of his George Green diddy-whackers, I'm going to start adding $1 million. And maybe that will make it worthwhile for the lawyer to go fight. I don't know. We'll see. Let's have some entertainment. I want somebody to read those lawsuits. It's entertainment. Some of you will have read the private writings. They're hardly private anymore, are they? So maybe if you're curious, possibly you need to ask somebody to let you see them now. I want to hear the first one from Abbott, and you'll have to give a little explanation as to what's going on and why he would send this. And then the other one defies all description. There is no explanation.
Can we get Rick to... No? Okay. Brent?
This is from Attorney Abbott, representing the plaintiffs against the Institute. And it said, plaintiffs consent to Attorney Ellie's request for extension of time to respond to second amended complaint.
Now, isn't that nice and clear?
Yeah. Plaintiffs, by and through their undersigned attorney of record, due by this document, advise this court and counsel for defendants that there is no objection to the request of Attorney Bradley Ellie for a 30-day extension of time within which to answer or otherwise plead to the second amended complaint filed in these proceedings on April 26, 1996. In the circumstances of this case, as well as in consideration of the conduct of the attorneys who have in the past and who do today represent the defendants, including with particularity the defendants Phoenix Ecker Ecker, undersigned counsel for plaintiffs believes himself obligated to set out for the record the following admonitory observations. Number one, the matters set out here and after are prompted in important part by a rereading of the Nevada Supreme Court rules, including rules 150, 159, 170, 172, 173, 181, 185, 186, 202, and 203. The Nevada Rules of Civil Procedure, including particularly NRCP Rule 11, and the Ninth Judicial District Court rules, including particularly NJDCR Rule 23. Everybody got that?
And does everybody realize that he had no opening to write this at all? None.
Number two. Matters hereinafter set out are in equally important part prompted by counsel having received, did read many hundreds of pages of documents filed in litigation in Nevada and California involving Phoenix Institute and its predecessors, E.J. Ecker, Doris Ecker, et al., together with various Phoenix Ecker communications by letter, particularly to lenders who had requested payments according to demand promissory notes held by them, radio reports, which I'm at a total loss as to what radio reports.
You.
Yeah.
You.
And I've never been on the radio, but he keeps saying I have. newspaper publications such as Contact and like documents. Number three, what is added below is based upon the presumption of the undersigned that the defendant's current counsel and indeed their predecessors did fully comply with NRCP Rule 11, particularly hewing in good faith to the continuing reasonable inquiry duty imposed on counsel, as well as engaging in conduct falling always within the Nevada Supreme Court rules applicable to professional conduct. And number four, further, I assume all counsel have read with care and understanding the exhibits attached to the original complaint and the first amended complaint in these proceedings, particularly those exhibits setting out the Dickey-Abbott-Abbott-Dickey exchanges of correspondence. All part of the records in counsel's hands are available to counsel apart from the previous filings as the affidavit of George W. Abbott respecting the claims of Schropfer and Fort against Phoenix Institute and Ecker-Ecker. Additionally, I make the same assumptions as to counsel's presumed, this is number five. Additionally, I make the same assumptions as to counsel's presumed reading and understanding of two more recent documents. A 10-page document entitled and dated, receiving number one, Hatton, Saturday, April 20th, 1996, 6:52 a.m., year 9, day 248, on the line, perhaps, and its complementary predecessor. An 8-page document entitled and dated, receiving number one, Hatton, Tuesday, April 16th, 1996, 7:48 a.m., year 9, day 244. Okay, legal people, the enemy has been once again delivered into your hands. What will you do? I can imagine a judge reading this and trying to make heads or tails of it.
Oh, the judges. I wish you could see.
It's got to be funny. Six. In connection with the foregoing paragraph 5, other counsel may wish to read or refamiliarize themselves with the language of NRS 199.320, including lawsuit or inducing lawsuit. Number 7. To repeat a matter included in an Abbott-Dickey letter of February 11, 1994, GWAAFF Exhibit 7, quoting, as soon as the Rule 11 claim has surfaced, promptly attempt to mitigate the problem by making a written request of your adversary to drop the claim or motion. Paraphrase of GWA or whatever particular matter is involved. End quote. Including disclaiming responsibility for such conduct as is reflected by such Hatton, Doris, EJ declarations as this one page on page 1, paragraph 5 in the April 20th, 1996 item. Quoting George Green and George Abbott are the epitome of evil, lying bastards.
They are. I go on record. They are.
Amen.
I concur.
They have pulled political ploys and have the very judges in Nevada serving them. Emphasis added.
Now look what he does with it.
And then he says, plaintiffs and their counsel trust the foregoing will help guide Attorney Ellie in his future conduct. Dated the 22nd of May, 1996, signed George W. Abbott, Esquire, attorney for plaintiffs.
Now, he told George Green, and Dave isn't here, Dave Williams, to verify what was in his conversation, an affidavit, and Paul Linthal. George Green personally told them that Leon Fort had a really good attorney. He didn't know him. But this is a really sharp attorney, and he's going after the lawyers. And this man has. He has shredded every lawyer that has gone in there for Phoenix Institute. He does that to them. In other words, Mr. Ellie, you better look. He cost Mr. Ellie his position with his law firm, but Ellie wanted to be leaving there anyway. This is dirty politics. And he makes it sound there like we're threatening the judges or something. No. The judges have been sucked into this and capitulate enough to allow this to go on and on and on. And regardless of what it does to our case, I will say the judges are looking foolish. And if justice stems because a client can't say that it looks like the judges are also involved, I want to know what you've come to. Does Doris Ecker have no right to speak up as a client to defend herself? And is there no client attorney privileges to be able to say, I don't like them, they're bastards? They have called these Ecker Phoenix people cheats, liars, thieves, RICO, you name it. And they're supposed to, because they serve God, smile and say, hit me again. And these were private, confidential writings.